lifting your spirit. Hi there, I'm Sarah. So when it comes to your most basic needs, most of us would say food, water, air, shelter. You take it a step further. Did you know that we can distill down our most basic emotional needs to love and belonging? Author and researcher Brené Brown has dedicated her life to the study of this, and she says that a deep sense of love and belonging is the irreducible need of all people. We're basically biologically hardwired to love, to be loved, and to belong. Now, you might not naturally assume that that would be the direction we'd turn when discussing a high-end, ultra-luxury, award-winning restaurant, but that beautiful theme is actually interwoven in our entire conversation you're about to hear with Mark Canlis. Canlis is the Pacific Northwest's most celebrated restaurant, voted most romantic, best view, best service, best design, top wine list and wine service, Washington Family Business of the Year, and best overall restaurant. Basically, if restaurants were Grammys, Canlis would be Adele. What's drawn me most, though, is the stories that I've heard of these two wholehearted, generous brothers who love to celebrate with others. So we begin talking with Mark about his family's legacy. Okay, so I love to just start a little bit like with your history. Fourth generation?
I am, yeah, fourth generation. My great-grandfather grew up in Lesvos, which is in Greece. And then famously, we always say, he ran away, but we think he swam, actually, to Turkey, and that's, like, according to Google Earth, that's, like, 5 miles or 4.8 miles, and then hitchhiked down to Cairo, and he got a job at the Hotel Mina, which is kind of a famous old, wasn't then, but old hotel, and Teddy Roosevelt was coming off his presidency and had just landed there, and he was looking for people to go on his safari with him. And so he must have met my great-grandfather and said, come on, come cook. And so for a year and a half or so, they traveled through Africa and shot a bunch of animals and, like, taxidermied a bunch of them and ate the rest. And, like, I know presidents don't do this anymore. I wonder why. And so anyway, yeah, so Roosevelt did this whole thing. And then at some point, a lot of that crew came through Ellis Island. And my great-grandfather ended up coming across the country to Stockton, California. So he opened a restaurant there, we think in 1909 or something, 1910, called the Seafood Palace. That's the name we got rid of at some point, which is probably a good thing. But yeah, Seafood Palace, 1910-ish. And he had some children with my grandma. She was Lebanese. A lot of the Greek and Lebanese population lived in Stockton, California. And so my grandfather just grew up in the restaurant business. He grew up in this family, old country kind of place, and did all his homework on the tables and that kind of thing. And that's the way it is now, and that's the way it was back then. And he just grew up cooking and learning about food. And at some point, he had the opportunity to run the restaurant a little bit. And he and his dad didn't agree on what it should be. My grandfather wanted some place that was just like, shoot for the moon, most beautiful restaurant in the world. He kind of wanted to make it. To be honest, I think he had kind of a chip on his shoulder from being an immigrant and seeing how hard his parents were working, and he wanted credit for it. And anyway, my great-grandfather didn't. He wanted a family place. And so Peter Canlis, my grandfather, went to Hawaii. We always joke that he swam. He didn't, probably, but who knows? Remarkable people in this family. And then, so he ends up out there and was selling dry goods when Pearl Harbor happened. And like a lot of people in Honolulu, went to the base and helped put out fires and just got involved. And at some point made a offhanded comment about the food. And then he ends up cooking. And then he ends up running a lot of the food on base, the USO, the officers club and that kind of thing. So he earned a reputation for being able to cook. And in 1947, opened a restaurant called The Broiler on a little unknown beach, Waikiki. And that is what turned into the Canlis restaurants. So there were four of them at one point. And he came here in 1950 and opened Seattle. And at some point, there was San Francisco and Portland. And then went back in 1954 and opened Canlis in Honolulu, which is the restaurant that many people remember. So yeah, and then here we are today. Whoosh, 100 years or so of restaurant history. My parents ran it for 30 years, from 77 when my grandfather died to about 2005, 2006. And now I do it with my little brother. And we're doing that for about 10 years. So it's a lot of fun.
What was that baton handoff like between your parents and your little brother and you?
Oh, man. Hard? Yeah. I made a ton of mistakes. And I came back in 2003. And so tried to run the restaurant for a couple years. It was really hard. You know, they have years of experience, you know, combined 50, 60 years of experience. And then here you are, this kid doesn't know anything. And it wasn't reckless. It was just not very good. At some point, Dad said, I think you need some help. and suggested, I was like, oh, yeah. And so he kind of floated the idea of bringing Brian back. And then, like parents do sometimes, like he floats the idea. And then on a road trip through Scotland, just sort of brings it up. Like, hey, Brian, your brother Mark's thinking about inviting you back to the company. Maybe emotionally ahead of where I was at the time, but it worked.
But it was Scotland. Yeah, it was a road trip through Scotland.
Just
like look out the window and just take in the vista.
There was bagpipes in the background. The sun was hitting the clouds. Yeah, Brian was in the Air Force. He was working with the Air Force One team at Andrews Air Force Base. And anyway, he just came back as an experiment, and it worked. Like, we loved working together, and it really helped me out a great deal. So, yeah, it was a hard transition. And it's like family transition is never easy. It's just not going to be. And but that doesn't mean it's not good. So I would say it was hard and good at the same time.
Just to even sit back and hear the story of, you know, your great-grandfather swimming to Turkey.
I know, right? Yeah. It's crazy. I think probably the truth of the matter, I mean, we've talked about this a lot as families, like broken it down, like the post after, you know, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
The thing I need to be on. So like, probably what happened is that he took a boat that wasn't willing to land, and then he jumped off the boat and swam in. But as far as we're going with family history, he swam all 4.9 miles like a boss, you know, from one country to the other, and then he hitchhiked down. So he, stud.
Stories tend to grow a little bit with each year. It'll be interesting the way that your own children recount this story.
Oh, absolutely.
In a few decades.
It'll be like with his, you know, new bride to be on his back with shark infested waters and, you know.
It's just going to get better.
With a tray of caviar in one hand held aloft over the waves, right? Like.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
probably didn't quite happen just like that, but I bet you it was very similar. It's very similar to that.
So with that history, we're going to transition into some of the founding principles that Canlis operates on. Yeah. And then I'm going to probably have you share a little bit, like expand upon those so that someone, they might not be in the restaurant industry, but we're going to start talking about things like hospitality, service, generosity, things that Canlis is known for. And I would start with excellence.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's so funny. When Brian and I came back, the Canlis had a whole bunch of values, like this big list of words, and they were really inspirational. They really, really were. My parents were listening to this. They were great words, Mom and Dad. No one could remember them, but one of them was excellence. And we sort of looked at these things and we thought, man, if we can't remember them, maybe the list is too long. And so one of the first things we did was pare those down to three words. And then we had to pitch that to our parents and to see if that was really striking at the heart of what they had been doing for 30 years. And that's the current generation's job, is to make the generation that you're taking over from comfortable with what you're doing. And those three words were trustworthy and generous and other-centered. And it's hard to let go of the other words, like hospitality and warmth and excellence and precision and whatever. But we just found that everything that we needed was wrapped up into those three words, and people could remember them. And for us, so much of what they were doing, Mom and Dad were way ahead of their time in terms of understanding that this industry was just about relationships. And for us, that trust word, trust is like the currency of relationships. So we got to wrap a whole bunch of stuff into that word and say, gosh, if you can trust someone, then there's a lot of foundation there to move forward. So, yeah, excellence is important. But if we weren't excellent, you wouldn't trust Canlis, right? So it's implied in that. The one thing I want to be known for is that it's a safe place. It's a place that you can trust.
How did you get to that process? You have to really distill down.
Oh, man. We were building a sign. I mean, yes. So here's the thing. We have a restaurant on a freeway, and anytime you do anything to the exterior of it, like the whole world comments. It's like I'll be out there, I don't know, picking a weed, and then I'll get a text from a neighbor. It's like, hey, nice job in the garden today, you know? And then like you're out there picking your nose and somebody honks and tweets about it. Like literally it's a really public place. So when we went to change a sign, we just had to think a lot about what does it mean to drive past that place and you see that building and its iconic 50s shape and you read those words and that word, canless. And so we wrestled with it for a long time. What does it mean? And what do I want it to mean? And what do I want to be known for? And what do I want my kids to know us as? Like, so that's how we got there. We said, excellence is great. I'd rather be known as being someone who's trustworthy.
You've mentioned before that when you're hiring staff, you have kind of one trump card question that helps them land the job.
Yeah, maybe we're a bunch of weirdos the way that we hire, but we do. We have the big question, and that's who are you becoming? Literally, the question sounds something like, how will working at Canless help you become who you're hoping to become? And we're pretty passionate about it. That's not a question you can ask up front. I don't think that's fair. I think we used to do that early in the interview, and I think to all those people that I dropped that one to, I don't think that's fair. It's a really vulnerable question. To answer it well takes a lot of introspection, and it takes feeling safe. And so now we do a few interviews, and then at some point we'll have you come in and stage and, you know, work a night just so you can get a chance to see what it's like to be on the floor, and you can get a chance to feel that out. And really we're just trying to get the person who's coming in to understand if that's what they want. And in so many ways, I think for us, that's a really important question. I think we see that throughout the scripture, and I think we're asked that all the time. What do you want? And it's a hard one to answer. So if I can start having that conversation with a new employee, then we start getting at the root of what really motivates and drives that person. And you bring somebody in like that, and suddenly you have an incredible employee, right? That's what the goal is. So that is the big question. And sometimes it takes all day or a few interviews or a couple of days maybe to get to it. But our job as employers is to do what's best for you. And if I'm not doing that, what am I doing exactly? I'm using you a little bit, and I don't want to be someone that uses other people. So,
what are some great answers you've heard to that question?
Oh, the best ones are you kind of get that like welling up in like people just freeze. Oh, okay, it's just what happens. You ask the question, and one of two things happens. One is you get like the deer in the headlights. The person has no idea, and you get the script answer, and I'm like, whoa, no, that's not where we're going. So often we'll have to take it to another place. Like, if you were the exact same person in 3 years, would you be happy or sad, right? And a lot of us have a desire to grow or to change or to become something, and that allows them to do it. Or sometimes I'll say, think of somebody that you love. And what if you lost them? Which is a terrible thing I know to do in an interview. But honestly, it gets you thinking in a particular way. It gets you thinking in, outside of how do I get this job and into, gosh, what really matters to me? And so when that question goes well, you have someone who's describing a hero or a role model, you know, a grandparent, and they are telling you all about this person, and they are telling you, man, you know, I even get emotional thinking about, like, my grandfather was this kind of a person, and he had an incredible work ethic, and he loved my grandma, you know. If you can talk that way, like, then you're getting somewhere, right? Now I know you, and now I know what drives you, and I know what you want to become. And my job is to help them become that. And if you're not becoming, you're really kind of in the wrong spot. I mean, that's what we would say. It's like, you got to be in a place where you can actually live into the person that you always hoped you could be. And so that's the idea. You push someone to that place and you say, gosh, what's going on inside of you? And then if you work here, are you going to become more that way, or are you going to become less that way? And if it's less, let me help you get a job somewhere else. And it's more, why don't you show up to work tomorrow? Like, that's sort of the dividing line. I don't really care how much experience they have. I don't really care. I mean, if you're working in the kitchen, you like, cut your fingers off, it's bad, right? So there's a There's some things that matter, but most of the folks we're hiring, particularly in the dining room, have little experience. That doesn't, we can train that stuff. So I'm just looking for people of character and people who know what it's like to grow.
Let's shift from your employees to your guests.
Mm-hmm.
So many people, Canlis is a destination, yes, for the food, but more for the relationship that they have going on at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share reasons people walk through those doors?
Yeah. It's not really because they're hungry. though they ought to be. They should be. It's a lot of food.
Yeah, because you were mentioning the other day that you can't make someone come to your restaurant. Still, every day, even after all these years, you open and you wonder, is anyone going to show up today?
It's the, like, for real. I mean, we just, every day at 5:30, you just wonder if people are going to come. And yes, most of them have reservations. And thankfully, they've been really full lately. But it's still a restaurant. And I say it to my kids, to the family, and to everyone all the time, like, you just don't know what tomorrow or what next year brings for your company. And we have had years where it's hard. We've had years where it's less hard. And so trying to understand what motivates people to come in to a place like Canlis is really important to us. And so we study them. We pay super close attention to them. And it's not what you'd think. People don't come just for the food or just for the service. I mean, yes, so the food's great. It's amazing. The service is exceptional. The view is beautiful. The wine list is world famous. That's not why we eat dinner together, right? And so people become because something in their life needs to matter. Like tonight needs to matter. And that ends up being what drives you to pick up the phone and make a reservation. You're saying to yourself, this is my daughter's 16th birthday. And I only have one of those. And tonight, that's that night. And tomorrow, it's gone. Like, you'll have a 17th birthday, but she won't have another 16th, right? Same thing with a woman having a C-section. Like, tonight, we're just a couple, and it's the two of us. And it's been the two of us for these years. And tomorrow, it's the three of us, you know, Lord willing, forever. And, that night's not going to happen again either.
You mentioned one about sisters that flew in across the country.
Yeah. Yeah, we had five or six. I think it was a party of seven. I think it was six sisters. And just maybe a year or two ago now, maybe a couple years ago. But their mom was dying of cancer. So they flew in. They flew in for dinner, for one last dinner with her mom, right? And the sisters lived all around the country. And I think the mom was getting treatment here in Seattle. And so if we're not aware of what's going on, we'll never be able to serve them. It isn't about the food for them, right? It isn't about the wine. It isn't about how well we describe a dish or how fancy is the linen. All those things have to happen. Those are just rules to the game. They have to be there in order to support what tonight's really about. Tonight's about one last dinner with my mom. One last dinner, the seven of us. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand. It's so funny, I've told that story a lot of times. I think what we're trying to do is to understand the guest on a different level. Yeah, when you when you stand at the front door of a restaurant, you have no idea what's going to walk in. And I think what's special about Canlis is that there's 95 of us who at the end of the day really just want to know what's going on with you. And they really just want to serve you. And you can't serve someone if you don't take a minute to step out of your world and into theirs. And so in that building, in that place, for 65 years next week, that's what's been going on. And that's what happened with the seven women upstairs, right? And that's what happens, gosh, every night. Like, every night we have a meeting, and every night I say, you guys, do you know what's happening tonight? I don't, but you have to believe that someone tonight has cancer. Someone tonight is having a miserable time. Someone tonight is celebrating something that they have waited forever for, right? Like, someone tonight is having an anniversary, and maybe years of their marriage have been hard, and tonight it's working. Yeah. Yeah, you just don't know where they're coming from. So it's the hardest part of the job, and it's easily the most rewarding part of the job, is to, for 2 hours or for 3 or 4 hours, enter in and be a part of, even just be on the, right on the periphery of, like right on the outside of, like you're, I mean, literally physically, you're standing just on the other side, just on the outside of that table, right? But yeah, the table is a special place. Yeah. So when we think of the guest, we try to think of them as, we try to understand like where they're coming from, like what place have they been in. And sometimes that means it's a someone from New York and they're super foodie and they're all geeked out on what Chef Brady is doing, and the way to serve them is everything is precision and it's on point and you're totally nailing descriptions and you're pairing the wines, and that is what they need. Like, what they need in that moment is just to be celebrated with food and technique and the beauty and the presentation of it and all of that. They have come around from around the world to do a tasting menu or to try a particular wine. You know, that's special. And sometimes what they need is space. Sometimes what they need is the simplest meal and none of the pomp and circumstance. They just need space. They need time to get at the table. And then for that table, you just stay in the background. You just disappear. You know, maybe you don't fold the napkin. Like, maybe you don't reach across and put the fork on the right side of the table, because that might be intrusive. So, like, to understand the guest is the beginning of service. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're just trying to figure that out every night. And it's like a big old puzzle. It's a big old mystery. You don't know what's going to walk in.
It requires a lot of discernment.
It requires a lot of discernment and a lot of, oh man, good old fashioned, like, what the heck are we doing? Like, literally, there's a lot of head scratching. If you could see what happens in the background of the restaurant, like, there's a lot of, like, does anyone know what's happening on table six right now? Like, no, I have no idea. In the coat room, like, there's a lot of poking around, peeking around corners and trying to, like, figure it out, you know? And sometimes we miss, like we miss big. We make big mistakes, and it's a bummer. It's heartbreaking. But often we get it right, and that is so fun. It is so rewarding, and feels good. That's what we're doing over there.
Is one of the reasons that it makes you emotional to talk about because you realize the weight of how deeply it matters year after year? Like, the more mm-hmm. you do this, have you only recognized even more?
You start to see... I think you do. I think you start to see the weight. You also start to get wrapped into the relationships. You watch families with multiple generations celebrate, and then one year, one Christmas, they come in and grandma's not there, right? And you start to realize that that year, that tradition, that 10 or 15, some families 30, 40 years of coming in and celebrating a holiday in a place, you see those generations change. You see the kids grow up, and you see the kids have kids. And you start to realize the role that you're playing. And I think it gives perspective. I think it kind of shows you your world is small and the big world is big out there. And sometimes it's broken and sometimes it is happy. And you start to engage in all of the joy of it and all of the messiness of it. And it's a lot. Like it just, and I think, I have to be honest, I think the other reason it can be emotional for me is that you're also dealing with your own stuff. And you run into that every night in the restaurant. Like, oh man, here comes somebody and I just don't have the space for them. Like I don't have the emotional margin for them, or I just, like, they just creep me out. I don't know what it is. Not to say that the guests creep me out, but, you know, sometimes you just don't have it. And that may be because of whatever. And so when that's the case, you just, we'd like tag team out. Like, hey, I can't deal with table 23. Like I can do 23, you know, and sometimes you swap out. And so for me, the restaurant is, it feels like a canvas. Like it feels like, okay, this is me. This is me right now. And this is what I have. And this is what I have to give. And that sign out there, that was a little piece of art, and this paint color and that tablecloth and this glass and that wine and the way these dishes go and that amount of salt, all of that is a little piece of what we're trying to paint. And yeah, you feel exposed. You feel like, whoa, I hope this is working. I hope people like it, you know. And they do. And sometimes they don't. And thank goodness that keeps us on our toes. But it is a pouring out. It feels like that. And I want that, you know, getting back to the interview, I want that for the staff. I want them to be able to come wholeheartedly onto that dining room floor, or into that kitchen, and pour themselves into what they're doing. And because of it, they became the person they always dreamed of. That's what we're doing. And if people want to know why it feels good in that restaurant, it's because that's what's happening with the people who work there.
Give me an example. It can be personal if you want, of maybe 3 years ago when you had an idea, in 3 years I hope to become more of, or it could be a story from someone on staff where you feel like you've seen the process that you just described. Mm-hmm. I want to become this, and then mm-hmm. you've seen that.
Oh man. I have seen that so many times, and that's like one of the most special things in the world. I see it with guests. I see it with staff. I've seen it in my brother, my own parents. I had a mirror. I watched it in myself. And you know, I'll say this about it. It's slow. And it's messy. And being invited into that is like one of the great privileges, I think. So am I thinking of something specific right now? No, not particularly, not particularly one that I would share on the radio either for myself or for somebody else. But, you know, we have a barrel of whiskey down there in that wine cellar that on a road trip brought back pretty much with my two brothers. And every once in a while we don't sell it. It's exceptionally rare stuff. Every once in a while we toast with it though. We toast to that growth. And so when someone on the staff says, hey, I think this is what's going on with me, or this is how I want to grow, or this is how I want to change, that's why that whiskey exists. You draw it out of the barrel with this long glass pipette, and you kind of suck it out with your thumb, and it pours in this tiny little glass. Like, here's this stuff that isn't anywhere else in the world. And we raise a glass to the courage to change. You come down in that cellar and you say, this is how I want to change. I'm like, I'll drink to that. Like, that's cool, right? And I can't tell you how many times we've all just been down there like weeping around this like barrel. But it happens. It happens with staff. It happens with random guests. I'm like, I don't even know you guys. And what are you sharing right now? And this is awesome, you know? So it does happen. I just think sometimes we all need an invitation into that. And I don't know, on a guest level and on a staff level, I want Canlis to be an invitation to grow. Yeah, to celebrate, to be together in a meaningful way. We need that, probably more than we're aware.
I know so many people listening to this they're going to be blown away by the humanity that you describe, the things that matter at the heart of who we are. And they're going to be wondering now how they can take their job as an electrician or a teacher or a stay-at-home mom and apply these principles to what their vocation is.
Yeah, I don't think this is Candlest specific in any way. And I think it's, let's see, how to answer that concisely. I think what we're doing there can be done in just about any job out there. I think what we're talking about is bringing your whole self. And that starts with like an embracing of who you are a little bit. Like, all right, this is me. It isn't perfect, but it's beautiful, it's glorious, and it's messed up, kind of all in one big jumbled together mess. And showing up to work that way is a frightening, vulnerable, and incredibly liberating thing to do. And if you're the only one showing up to work that way, I would emphasize the frightening piece if everyone else is pretty closed off. But it, in a work community where people get that, like in a safe environment, then, oh, it's like it's the most amazing thing. It really is. And so, you know, for anyone in charge of a company out there, I would say, wow, you know, what's so scary about creating an environment where that can be true? And a lot of businesses that we speak with, a lot of leaders that I work with are hesitant to do that because it's maybe a little countercultural. And I think it is, I think Candlest is an experiment in this. I think it's a hypothesis. I don't think we have it figured out. And I don't think we have all the answers. And I think often we make a mistake too far on the other end. But if I'm gonna make a mistake, I'm going to make a mistake in that direction. And that's been our goal, is how do we create an environment where this is a safe place? And that's why trustworthy is the number one value for us. Like it just has to be. So we become like the people we spend time with. That just is true. And I don't know how to apply it necessarily. Kind of all I know is restaurants in so many ways, but I do find
parenting. You've got three children.
Yeah.
How do you incorporate a couple of the, like, how do you become trustworthy for your children?
Well, let me say this and then I'll answer that question. I don't think that it's just me and the Candlest staff who's in the business of relationships. I kind of think that most all business is about relationships. And if that's the case, then most business is about trust. All relationships are around trust. I don't care if that's you and your spouse, you and your girlfriend, your Aunt Trudy, your cat. Like, your cat loves you because it trusts you. Or maybe it doesn't because it's a cat. But your dog, I could talk about a dog because I don't even have a cat. But, like, your dog trusts you or it doesn't. You know, and vice versa, like, right? And that's the same with, like, every relationship that we're in. Like, they're based on trust. So I just think that most of business is about relationships. It really is. So I don't think that the trustworthy thing is just unique to Candlest. And I do think it's applicable sort of across the board in a lot of different ways. I also think that the way that I raise my kids and the kind of husband that I am is the same that I am at work. So there's no real separation between church and state in that way. Right? There's just one you. There's not like you at work and then you at home or you professionally and you personally. There's you doing personal things for you, and there's you doing professional things at work, but there's kind of only one you. I take a lot of the lessons that I learn as a dad end up coming forth in a fine dining restaurant. A lot of the things I'm trying to understand as a husband end up coming out on one-on-ones with my staff. Like, it's just who you are as a leader, and it's who you are as a person. And I'll tell you this, I got a long ways to go, but understanding that that's one journey and not two has been really helpful. I hope one day that someone would say, oh, that Mark Candlest guy, not he was a great restaurant guy. I would hope it's just like, he's a great guy. That's what matters more. That's what I would want my kids to think. That's what I'd want, I don't know, anyone to think, right? So I do think that we're often, especially culturally, tempted to separate our personal and professional selves. And that's not a path that I want to go down. It's confusing. You end up compromising both of them. And it could be hard on morale. So we invite our staff to come as who they are. Like, this is you. If you're having a hard day, I got you. Because tomorrow I'm going to have a hard day, and I need you to get me. But if you're having a hard day, I don't want you to hide that and pretend like everything's fine because you're putting on your professional self. Everything isn't fine, right? Your world's messed up, and I can handle that. I have space for that. And so when we talk about those other two values, generous and other-centered, that's the generosity. I'm not asking my staff to give money. Generosity isn't a financial word. Anyone can be generous, right? It's a condition of the heart. It's a decision. And so we're just deciding as a staff, we're going to make some room. We're going to carve out space for somebody else, somebody else's bad day, somebody else's hard week. That's generous. And in so many ways, I see this city as a generous city in that regard. Yes, we have a lot of philanthropic causes and initiatives here, and it's incredible. But again, I particularly this time of year, yeah, I don't see generosity as a financial thing. I see it as a condition of your character, of your soul. It's a decision you make in your heart, and it is hard, and it is worth it. And I am terrible at it. It's the truth. But it's who I'm hoping to become. When someone asks me that question around the barrel, yeah, you're going to get those values. I hope I'm trustworthy. I want to be generous. I want to learn how to be other-centered, and it is hard.
You mentioned that you believe that the Pacific Northwest, Seattle in particular, is a generous city. You recently had a opportunity to witness that firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
The accident happened feet away from your restaurant.
A couple hundred feet down the road. And that was a hard day. That was my birthday, actually, and my dad and I were off spending some time together. So my brother was there at the restaurant. I think what stands out to me about the accident on the bridge was the turning towards, and by that I mean, so two of my staff watched that thing happen from one of the window tables, and she ran into the next door room where all of the chefs, Brady and his team of sous chefs, were meeting around a table, and she said, "Gosh, something terrible has happened." And then they all ran out the back door onto the bridge. And each of them not knowing what they would find. And what's so remarkable about their response is I think it's a picture of all of us all the time. You run down a bridge towards an accident and you can't make sense of it. It is a lot of confusion. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of unknown. But you go towards it anyway. And they did. And they ran down there, and, you know, some of them just got there and didn't know what to do. And some of them helped out in various ways, and some of them jumped up there and found people. Others just found them on the street and held them. What was beautiful about that to me is that each of them, in their own ways, turned towards the hurt. And that's something that I admire. That's generous. That's just saying, this isn't going to feel good to me. I'm not capable of fixing this, but I'll give you what I have. Sometimes that's just presence. Sometimes that's just holding someone who's dying. Sometimes that's even looking upon someone who has already passed away because their mom can't, and somebody needs to witness that. So it's, I think all of us all the time are walking past an accident. And that accident could be me having a miserable day. And that accident could be you having a hard time with your marriage. And that accident could be my 3-year-old with a sliver. And that accident could be a car accident on the bridge. What I'm proud of the staff and my brother for is just the way they responded with their big hearts. And sometimes it's all you can do. And was it enough? No. No, it wasn't enough. But I don't think they were called to have enough. Yeah, I think they were called to respond. So I admire that. Like, I want to be somebody who responds well. And so often, I don't have the answers. None of us do. It's like, oh man, here we are. I don't know what to do. But turning towards the hard thing, I think is a great start.
So much of what you share in that story and just in some of the lessons that you've learned, it intersects with what you believe in your heart about God. Can you share a little bit about where that faith comes from for you or your faith journey?
Mm-hmm. My older brother's a minister, and he's been doing that a long time. At one point he said, hey, Mark, I think I only have one sermon. I just keep hitting the same point over and over. And the story that I remember, man, I'm going to butcher this, but, you know, you got two guys walking along, following Jesus through a desert or something. In my head, it's like a desert. There's no cactuses, but there's definitely like sand. And anyway, he like turns around and he says, you know, what do you want? And that moment for me is a picture of, what am I trying to say? I can envision being those two guys following and not having a good answer. I can envision Jesus turning around and saying, hey, you're following me. What do you want? And me being like, I don't know, but I am going to keep following you. I think we're drawn to things and sometimes without understanding them. And maybe that's the story of my faith. I'm not sure I understand it, but I'm drawn to it. I think that we are constantly asked by our Savior, what do you want? And I think that's the beautiful thing, is that he gives us tons of freedom. He allows us to make good and bad decisions. He allows us to do whatever we want down here. But I think he lovingly keeps asking that question and helping us discern for ourselves what it is that we want. What I want is to keep following, even though sometimes I don't get it and sometimes it seems like I don't want that. So I want to respond well, to take it back to what we were just talking about. I don't know. Maybe that's why the restaurant is a good place for me or for us as a family. Maybe it's the way we were raised. It's kind of our own curiosity. And it's a place we get to explore that a little bit. It's a place we get to figure out what we want. And yeah, it's a vetting ground, if you will, slash crucible. It's awesome. And I do love it. Good, hard, difficult, emotionally beleaguering, joy-filled, completely uplifting. Like, you can't imagine the range of emotions, like a bad Rocky movie. Like, it just goes up and down, you know what I mean? And that journey, that adventure, that's not just me. I don't think in a restaurant. I think that's so many of us going to work or in our daily lives. And I think we're being asked that question all the time. Whether we can see the one asking it or not, beats me. I don't think that matters. I think all the time we're being asked, what is it that you actually want? And do you want me? And, you know, in my own marriage, it's the same way, right? We all want to be loved and wanted. And I think it's that way with our kids. And I think it's that way with our employees. And I think it's that way with our families. And so, yeah, this is an expression of our faith in so many ways. But I also just think it's an expression of who we are, right? Like, I wouldn't differentiate. This is my faith me, and this is my professional me. Again, there's just me. You get one of me. Thank goodness. It's probably all the world can handle.
Thank you cool. for your time.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for having me.